My name's Andrew Hunter. I'm the senior curator at the Art Gallery of Guelph, and I'm here today with
Jeff Thomas. I'm a photo-based artist and prepared to talk about my recent exhibition, Birdman Rising, in Edwardsville, Illinois.
This is an exhibition that's at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. Took me a while to get that down.
Yeah.
Edwardsville, for folks listening, you may not know, is just across the Mississippi River from St. Louis. And so this is an exhibition that opened recently, but it's rooted in some work you've been doing for a long time, thinking about the Mississippian cultures around that part of what is now the United States. So can you start maybe by telling us a bit about your initial interest in that area? When did you first go down there?
Well, my first trip to Cahokia took place in 1992. At the time, it was the big hype was the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus. And I wanted to respond to that by taking a road trip through the United States and looking at different facets of commemoration, in particular monuments and like Mount Rushmore in the Black Hills. And then part of the trip was also to stop at the Cahokia Memorial Mound site because of the kind of monumentality that the Mississippians left behind in terms of the earth structures that they had built. One of them, Monk's Mound, the central one, being three stories high. So that was my first visit there in 92, and it was a brief stop. We just stopped, climbed to the top of the three-story mound, and then went on to other places. But the reason that it became my first stop was based on my previous research for my powwow work, and looking at the traditional powwow dancer and the dance bustle that they wear, and wondering how far back in time I could locate its origin. Mm-hmm. So that had always been a question. And so I was interested in the Mississippians because they had a mythological figure called Birdman, which was a dual kind of man, bird of prey kind of combination. And so it seemed to me that there was a link to the Birdman, and I wanted to find out. So yeah, my first stop was in 1992, and it was very brief, but it kind of laid the groundwork for something in the future.
This is a really important archaeological site now. I think it's the largest in North America. Basically, it consists of these mounds there's a concentrated area, which is called the Cahokia kind of site, which is in Illinois, but then there are mounds that spread out actually in the city of St. Louis, and it was quite a large area, and it was an urban area. These were people that had built a city with a suburb and with outlying agricultural areas. And so I think knowing the history of your work, that urban aspect is also important to you, correct?
Yeah, and that was, I guess there were really two lines of thought that went into Cahokia, and it was of course the Birdman, but the first one really was the idea that before the arrival of the Europeans, we had a civilization that in the 10th, 11th century was comparable to the size of Paris at that time. And as you had said, Cahokia, the World Heritage Site, is located in Collinsville, Illinois, which when you stand at the top of Monk's Mound, you can see a bit of the outline of St. Louis. So there's about, I think, 17 miles between St. Louis and Cahokia. And all along that area, they've been finding mounds all along that area. And in fact, St. Louis was called Mound City in the earliest days because there were still existing mounds there. And they were depleted over a period of time because soil was used for other construction projects, like for the railroad beds and things like that.
Yeah.
So there's photographs from the 1840s that show the mounds being dug up and carted
away. Yeah, there's that great shot of the Big Mound, as it's called, which is... The site is on Mound Street and right at the footing of this big fancy new bridge that crosses the Mississippi. But it was just like 1870s. There's daguerreotypes of it being shoveled out.
Yeah.
Also, part of the history of that is like initially people didn't think they were the result of a human culture. They thought they were natural. They thought these were just formed from the Mississippi River flooding and expanding and making oxbows and stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, there certainly was an agricultural component to that, and why that was so important was because it introduced cultivation of corn to North America, And this was one of the reasons why Cahokia flourished, because no longer were they hunter-gatherers, but they had the time to begin developing their societies. Mm-hmm. Ceremonial, structurally, all those aspects came into play that really became quite a sound social structure in North America. And nobody believed, like in the early days, that it could have been indigenous people that made it. There were all kinds of theories going about
aliens,
like, the crazy
sure.
ones from aliens in that, to the fact that it was people that came up from Mexico. Mayans came up and influenced the building of these. But they say that there are no soil earth mountains south of the border, so this is the only place where they developed. So there's that really complex history that I think is so important. Not only to, you know, when I started looking at it, to me it made sense because I was talking about developing, you know, some kind of conversation on urban indigeneity, and here was an example of the fact that we did have that as part of our history. So when we think about urbanization today, we think, well, this isn't a part of our culture, our history, but it is in fact a part of our DNA. So how do you touch base with that again in today's current climate in addressing the importance of the urban indigenous population? Even in Winnipeg this past week, they signed an agreement to hand over the Armed Forces Base to the people in the area. And now they're calling it like Canada's first urban reservation or reserve. So the idea of urbanization is building year after year importance in addressing how do we define ourselves as urban-based indigenous people.
You were talking about some of the conversations that people or suggestions by research of where the people may have come from, but what are your thoughts about where the people went? They did have really remarkable trade networks. They were trading for copper from what would be, you know, north of Superior, so they had networks. But, you know, it's about 600 years ago, that is that right, that they figure the people dispersed?
Well, but I think it had reached its apex by about the 12th century.
Okay.
Yeah. And so at that point, people did begin to disperse. And so they've been able to link some of the more modern times, like the Osage and that, to the ancient Mississippians. So there's a bit of theorizing about contemporary indigenous people and how are they identified. So what's interesting about working with Cahokia, because you have the archaeology, which is, you know, like intense social science, and then you have like our own kind of storytelling and mythology, and in my mind they're kind of coming up and butting heads. Comes out of it is a stream of thought that is not based on fact, but in fact becomes something of a new way of defining mythology in terms of, are we at a new stage?
Yeah.
And in my mind, that's what I feel. I don't feel like I have to adhere to what archaeologists, well, is that real or not? Oh, your suggestion is crazy, you know, that couldn't possibly happen. And one of the things that that I'm exploring right now is the link between Cahokia and the formation of confederacies in Ontario and New York State between the Huron and the Iroquois. Our people date the formation of the Confederacy to about the year 1040-something, I think, because there was a solar eclipse. And when they count back in time with all the traditional chiefs in that, it goes back that far in time. So my feeling is that there was probably something going on in terms of people going south or going north and bringing this idea of formation of civilizations to form confederacies. How did these confederacies form with Huron all of a sudden? And how were they then carried over? Because they say the peacemaker was Huron. So in my mind, I began looking at linking and mapping these areas, and sure, there could have been a very strong possibility that what we have today as the Iroquois Confederacy could have had its roots or influence down with Cahokia.
And you've also thought about corn, the spread of corn as an agricultural crop coming out of the Mississippian and Cahokia, and how it becomes so critical to your people and others in this part of the world, that it really becomes a foundational crop, right?
Yeah. And that's why I've been working on a series called White Corn, because although it's a small series of work, it still touches base with the tradition of corn and the impact that it's had on our world. And of course, you know, the fact that, you know, it began down in the south and migrated up north. And so we're talking about centuries and centuries of migration. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it did come about. And this is the point that I was looking at too, is that it came about in the dispersion of the Mississippians, which really seemed to me to be kind of heading up for a conflict with European arrivals.
Right.
I think it was setting the stage, and not having such a large centrally located body of people and dispersing across meant that things were spreading out. And of course, the kind of the arrival was disease, spread of disease. And so you think about how we've survived today.
Right.
It's amazing when you look and you think that we're still here today. How did we survive? And I think that it all goes back to
a kind of dispersal, not being like all concentrated in one place.
Yes. Yeah. And I think they knew. They knew that something was coming and they had to prepare for it.
Yeah. So talk about the Birdman, because this is, it's a thread. It's been there in your work. Like you say, you were interested when you were doing the powwow work of these kind of birdmen figures. But it's also, it's a being that appears in many cultures, right? That, again, like you say, with this kind of dispersal. Can you talk a bit about the Birdman?
Well, like you say, every society across North America has some form of version of a relationship to the Birdman figure, Thunderbird and things like that. And even, with my own culture, there's eagle dance and things like that that are a part of it. But it really began, I think, for me, from a dream that I had one time. And in the dream, I was sitting in this house, and all of a sudden, it was during the day, and all of a sudden, very dark. So I went out and stood on the front porch and looked, and you could see the thunderstorm coming in, and the clouds were swirling, and almost like a tornado or something like that. And then I looked down at the gate to in front of the house, and there was this huge black man standing there. And on his shoulder was a raven. And of course it wasn't like African-American man or something like that, but it was this kind of very, very dark figure. And sometimes we refer to thunder as our grandfathers and that. And so in my mind, it seemed like he was that type of thunder figure that was coming through. And then kind of like the storm dispersed and then he left and the dream kind of ended at that point. But in my mind, there was something that kind of was setting me on the road to trying to understand what that meant. Mm-hmm. So, there's things, ideas, and questions that we grow up with, and they seem to kind of continue to manifest themselves for me throughout my career. And so the question was always, well, what was the relationship between the bird of prey and the male figure? And what I was really intrigued about it was like looking at the contemporary powwow, the use of featherwork, the dance bustle, but also too, how could that be incorporated into a conversation about self-determination? How do we empower ourselves? And how do we go about doing it if we're not part of a specific tribal group or whatever? It's like, how do we do that? And the same thing with naming my son Bear. I gave him three names when he was born, and he could choose when he became an adult which one he wanted to use. So his legal name is Aaron, but everybody knows him by Bear. But the idea was the power of the bear. I wanted him to feel a part of that.
Yeah.
And so it's worked out very well for him. But that's the idea. And so I was really interested more in not so much in... I wanted to uncover history to consider how do we use it today, because when we look back at residential schools and things like that, how history was severed, how community relations was severed, how the family network was severed. And so where does that leave us? And so it all comes back, it all really filters back to my own journey about indigenous male role models and the ones that I didn't have. So what did I do about that? Mm-hmm. Well, I all of my work began to evolve around that, and having a son was a part of that as well. So I think there's just, in my mind, there's a real sense of healing, and how do you unlock both the analytical mind and the creative mind to consider these things, because one could take over the other, but we're always trying to find a balance between the two. So this was a perfect way for me to look at a mythological figure from centuries and centuries ago and think, well, how do we connect to it today?
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of see it like there's just this river of knowledge that exists out there, and so I'm kind of like coming into it and trying to tap into it a bit and to mm-hmm. see what comes from that, and then how do you use it?
You also once told me a dream you had about confronting these sort of bird men in the basement.
Well, this was a part of the first one.
Oh, okay.
And so the way that the dream continued on is that eventually the storm ended. I walked down the stairs, and then I turned to walk back in the house, and underneath the house, you could see like a basement window, and there was light coming from it. So I was really curious, so I walked over and kind of crawled underneath the porch and realized that it was in fact a little door. Mm. So I was able to open the door and then crawl through it. And so I was on my hands and knees going through the bottom of the house. And then I came into another door, opened it up, and it was a room that was well lit and had a group of men inside. I think there were six or seven of them. They were sitting around a table playing cards. And they were all like, the way that they dressed was kind of a combination of European and traditional clothing, so typical of the 19th century. And they turned around and they looked at me, and when they did, I noticed that they all had these really long fingernails. And in my mind, I thought maybe that was a sign that they were ghosts. And so they turned and looked at me, and then that was it. And then I found myself out in front of the house again, and this time I went through the gate, started walking down the road, and then these kids started attacking me, throwing stones at me, making fun of me because I was an Indian and that. And I think that that dream was really about, when I look back on it now after all these decades of work, is that it seemed that it was really a part of the journey that I was on. You know, it's like I was being sent out, as I had been empowered by my elder, Emily General, to go out and to be strong enough and be adventurous enough to explore and navigate and do these things. And so, in another way, it seemed to relate to work that I would eventually do, like with the young kids attacking. I was thinking about like a connection to residential school. And although my parents never went to a residential school, I think we all kind of, indigenous people suffer some level of stress from that history, whether it's directly or whether it's like systemic racism or whatever. And so the real challenge, I think, is how do we empower ourselves? And how do we listen to our dreams or do we dismiss them? And if we decide to use them, then how do we go about employing them as a part of the work that we do? You know, the interesting thing is that when you mention that, I never really thought about who they were, but they very well could have been an extension of the man that was in the front of them. They were the ones, because what had really set me onto the birdman journey was I was at a powwow in Sioux Valley, Manitoba, and I was photographing some dancers, and I was standing next to these two older men, and they were talking about all the young traditional dancers that were wearing bustles.
Right.
And they questioned whether or not they knew the history behind the dance bustle, because of course, at one point in the 19th century, it was only worn by highly decorated veterans that could actually wear it. Because it was, unlike today's powwow, there was what was called the grass dance, or the Omaha Society. And so it was a men's society. And so they would get together for their dances, and they all had certain badges of honor that they wore. And the highest one was the dance bustle. And you can actually see some of the ones in 19th century photographs.
Yeah.
But then it got me to thinking about, well, how much do I know about the structure of that particular type of dance, traditional dancer,
yeah,
and its relationship to the historical grass dance in Omaha society?
Yeah.
So in my mind, there was kind of, now you think there's kind of a link between those two old guys that I was listening to and all those men at that table,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, you can certainly make a link.
Yeah.
Them.
Yeah, and just to sort of explain to folks listening, like a bustle is worn sort of lower back. It's on the back of the dancer, and it's usually eagle feathers, isn't it?
Yeah,
isn't that
almost always eagle feathers.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's varying configurations. Sometimes the original grass dance bustles were very small, so it would sit at the waist, but there would only be like one level, bottom level of feathers.
Oh, okay.
And then there was a point when I was living in Winnipeg in the 1990s, early 1990s, that the trend was these enormous dance bustles where you could walk behind a dancer and not see him. Because the bustle was so big.
Okay. Yeah.
And I photographed one of those.
Yeah.
And but the real, I think the turning point for me that came the last year that I lived in Winnipeg, I was working for the Aboriginal Justice Inquiry, photographing the justice system throughout Manitoba. So I had a lot of access, and one of them was the AFN had their elections that year in Winnipeg, and there was also a powwow. So I went to the powwow, and I was able actually to get on the dance floor, the arena. So I was standing at one point, like only a couple of feet away from the dancers, and there was this one. Sometimes when a drum group is really good and they don't want them to stop, the dancer will dance up to the drum, hold up his staff, and eventually there's some kind of payment or whatever to, you know, keep it going. At this particular one, I was standing at the spot where this drum was really kicking it, and then they formed off this line of probably about 20 or 30 traditional dancers. So you can imagine that they created a pathway. They're all looking in like that. They're all dancing in place and the drums going. One dancer comes down and he's like, oh man, it's just so powerful. And he gets up to the drum and then blows his whistle over it. And I watched that time after time. And I realized that there was something about being so close that you could almost smell the leather and you could almost feel like you could hear the feathers moving. And that's what I went to Winnipeg to find. I said, I need to go to Winnipeg and live there for this period of time. And I had to find this experience. And so the last thing I did in Winnipeg was that powwow. And so that was really like the real kick to getting this whole Birdman journey underway. Mm-hmm. And then, is it possible to kind of unravel these different pockets of history and come together and have some form of continuity in terms of a story? So
we've known each other for quite a while. We're working together on an exhibition, and a kind of, I guess the best way to describe it, unlike some things we've done before, this is really a kind of a retrospective, but not in a traditional kind of museum sense of like, you know, like a linear Western model, but to sort of say, here we are, you're at this moment in your life, your career, reflecting on all the work you have done and where you're headed, and we're trying to build a show that is structured around possibly various different threads, always moving back and forth in time. I wanted to ask you today, like, what's on the horizon right now with your work? Because you're always ridiculously busy, right? You're always doing stuff.
Yeah. I always say, no, I'm not that busy. And then all of a sudden I get, like, incredibly busy and everything's happening at the same time. Yeah. I was giving a couple of talks not too long ago and talking about the role of my elders in my life. And I've come to the point where I'm probably at the same age they were when I was talking to them as a young kid.
Right.
And I think in our culture we have this, like, when do you become an elder? And not to say that, just to say, because elder, I think, is sometimes it's a person that's had life experiences that are relevant to somebody else and they can learn from it.
Yeah, it's not about age.
No, it's not about age, but it's about what you learn and how you use that. And I found myself finally at the stage of my life where I feel comfortable telling the story that I want to tell. I've never felt like that throughout my whole art career in terms of exhibitions until this stage of my life where I feel like I'm finally ready to begin telling the story that I want to tell. And as my elder had said when I was a young kid, she says, you have to have many life experiences before you tell your own story. And so I've kind of lived my life by that. And so I think that, it's not a retrospective, as you say, in a traditional sense, but it is kind of a reflection on what I've been able to learn over the course of, this will probably be 37 or 38 years of work and inquiry into identity and masculinity,
right,
and role models, and whatever you found after all this period of time. And what I'm finding more and more now is the availability of new technology, because I never felt that I could just do a photo-based exhibition to accomplish it, because storytelling is such a part of our culture. So now I'm looking at really developing more of an installation-based project, which I've never done before. So there's lots of ideas in terms of what to bring into it in terms of architecture, how do I want the photographs displayed, and different kind of questions. And what does an architectural structure like the Earth Lodge, what does that represent in terms of a metaphor for my work? And, well, it comes back to this place where the imagination was nurtured. And so how do we wake that up again?
Right.
And people who had lost it. And I was talking to another class in Mississauga not too long ago, a very multi-racial, ethnic group of students, and that's what I was talking about. I said, you know, photography is the greatest tool that you could begin a conversation about identity with, because you can picture yourself in relationship to the world. How can you have that power to be able to do that? And so I think that this is, it all comes down to, it's all filtered now through through this lens of maturity and what comes out of it.
Can you talk a little bit about that relationship with Bear? And for those who don't, Bear is Bear Witness, A Tribe Called Red, and he's also an artist in his own right. But you had said that, like, I used to be, now I'm just Bear's dad.
Yeah, it's really funny. It's because Bear became a part of my work when he was 7 years old, and I photographed him over 2 decades. People identified Bear through photographs they made of him. And so he was always kind of cool with that. You know, he didn't mind in that. And so when he became more known with A Tribe Called Red, it was really interesting because all of a sudden people wanted to show, they were requesting the Bear series, exhibitions.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And so it was kind of, I know that there was something that was beginning to change, but it was when I would give a public talk and I would mention Bear Witness, and people would get all excited. And all of a sudden, I realized that I was being identified through Bear Witness, you know. And so there was a reversal. And I thought it was a really important one because, there's nothing more than I want my son to have than success at what he has. And he carries on, I think, what I've been working at for such a long period of time. And so, you know, I have no problem being it now. So,
it's a good point you make in the work that either on his own or through Tribe Called Red, that you see that legacy, you see that connection to you. And actually, when I gave my talk down in Illinois at Southern Illinois University, I started talking a bit about my background, but then I began to talk about your work, and then I paused and showed a performance video of Tribe Called Red, the one for missing and murdered Indigenous women with two powwow dancers and everything. And that kind of like really galvanized the attention of the group, and then moving into like your work. So it was like, in a way, that video really set them up to like, oh, okay, there's this work by this artist is resonating through a younger generation, and that really clicked with them.
Yeah, I think what I told Bear one time is I said I was really envious of him because they could go out and they could perform and have a couple hundred people or over a couple thousand people at their performance, and when they're up there and you see the audience, everybody's moving, and it's just not just simply Indigenous people or people of a specific age group. It's really remarkable to watch them and see how what they do gets people moving in unison. And I said I was envious of that because as a visual artist, I'm never going to have that in an exhibition space. But by extension, I can live kind of through Bear's work in that way to know that the message is reaching those masses. So. And he's the product of me, and he's part of my work, whether he wants to be or not.
Yeah.
And what I also like too is that he recognizes it.
Yeah.
And he's also upfront about it when he's, you know, when he's giving talks. And the idea is that it's showing a relationship between a father and a son.
Yeah.
I never really knew who my father was as a person because of his alcoholism. But what it did was inspire me to not do our same relationship with my son. And you can emotionally cut off for a lot of different reasons. It doesn't have to be alcohol-based.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was just that whatever I did as an artist was also kind of in unison with my role as a father.
Right.
So they went hand in hand.
Yeah.
And now that he's up and he's, you know, 40 years old now, it's continuing to work in a larger scope.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's great to see you. As
good
always,
to see you too.
We're sitting in the window of the Second Cup
Bank
Street, where we often meet, and which is closing. So next time I see you, we'll likely be somewhere else, I think.
Yeah, it definitely
will
be.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to send out something to let people know that I'm no longer here in
the
window.
Yeah. Anyways, thanks, Jeff.
You're welcome. Yeah.